Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
This is Patricia Camilleri welcoming you to University Matters on Campus FM. In this series, together, we shall continue to discover more about the work of the university's academics and about the many activities that will be taking place on campus over the next year. I'm very happy to have with me in the studio today on University Matters for Campus FM, Sir Julian Zarb. Just a few words about my guest. He's a present resident visiting lecturer at the Institute for Travel, Tourism and Culture, but he has had 36 years experience within the tourism industry, commencing with the first 25 years within the hospitality sector, working in the food and beverage departments of hotels and restaurants in both in UK and Malta. In 2003, he moved into the public sector, occupying various posts, including that of Director Tourism at the Ministry of Tourism and Culture. He has been involved with a number of NGOs, including the Hotel and Catering Institutional Management Association, Malta Group, the Malta Cookery and Food Association, and as founder-president of the Malta Tourism Society, and as vice-president of the European Union of Tourism Officers. And as I said, he's now visiting lecturer at the Institute of Travel and Tourism here at the university, and he lectures in international tourism development, sustainable tourism, and Malta's tourism development. And he's currently undertaking a doctoral study related to the process and implementation of local tourism planning in Malta. So welcome to the programme, Mr.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for having me on the station. It's a wonderful step back into the past, by the way, because Vardital Universitas, as Campus FM used to be called, was the first place that I actually came in front of a microphone, came to present these programs.
So now you're the other side of the mic. I know that you want to quite rightly speak about the what you're doing at the moment, and I think that's important, but just to give a bit of a brief, very basic outline of how tourism has developed in the last, well, since the 1960s, I suppose.
And to a lot of people, tourism is, as you say, the last 50 years, last 60 years, you know, it all sort of evolved in the 60s. Whereas the concept of tourism, not only in Malta, but I mean, if you look at the international development of tourism, actually goes a long way back. I mean, the idea of travel, the idea of looking for either alternative sources of education, it could be for religious purposes. There were a number of reasons why people travelled, and these were the actual sort of beginning of what we now today call the tourism industry. And indeed, that word tourism stems from that word grand tour. The grand tourist was that person who actually would leave his home. I mean, they were came from the affluent family, so obviously they could afford to do this. They left their home within Europe, and they usually travelled to the Levant and to the Mediterranean areas. Indeed, Malta was part of the Grand Tour because we had here a mini European Union. We had eight lungs from the European countries, and all of them had friends and relatives within Europe, so most of them would come here to actually experience what their friends and families had for them here. So that's how it was put on the map. Many, many famous names, men of letters, you know, I mean, and all of them left that sort of effect or that sort of experience in writing, which is good for us, you know, and that gives us as well an idea of the social and the cultural history. So we don't only just know about our tangible history, we don't just know about what we normally learn and what we normally show the tourists, you know, the palaces, the churches, that's the tangible side. But through these writings, we also know a bit about the social cultural aspect, and that's what really interests me here, especially in my research. So when we look at the history of tourism, I think we have to divide it into two. We have to have the first part, let's say the first part of the 20th century, which was dedicated to the traveller. Okay, we had about 4,000 or 5,000 a year who came from about 1925 to 1939, mainly obviously through the sea travel, but then it took off after the war when, literally, because it was actually the airlines and the air travel which made tourism as popular as it is today. So, and we actually moved along with the different trends, international trends and changes within tourism, because if you notice, even in other countries, there was a move from the sort of wintertime tourists, which was what we had before the war. We had a wintertime tourist from 1925 1939 to a summertime, to a leisure tourist, and this was, you know, the way that tourism developed and molded. So there was nothing really obscure or nothing different to any other destination, because tourism in Malta developed very much on a parallel with other destinations. What I do feel is that in Malta, I think we were one of the pioneers in the Mediterranean for developing tourism, long before, I think, Cyprus, ironically, in Greece, and North Africa, for sure, developed tourism. And so we do have a long history of hospitality and service. What we need to look at today is revisiting that hospitality and service in terms of the people who provided it, in terms of us, in terms of our local communities, because otherwise I'm afraid that what will happen with tourism here is we will just become an over-commercialized, stereotypical tourist destination, and that is what is happening to a lot of destinations today. They are realizing, places like Spain, places like North Africa, they are realizing this is the case, and they need to change their strategy and policy. And a lot of developments are happening in this respect.
Probably Malta is always going to be a sunsea destination, in the sense that, yes, we have beautiful sea, we have beautiful sun, so that's not going to go away. But one,
we need to take care of it.
We need to take care of
that. And I think this is what we need to really understand.
Mm.
Mainstream tourism, yes, on an island. It is an island surrounded by seawater, surrounded by coasts, at least on the eastern side. It's low-lying coastal areas. There are environmental issues which we need to consider, and this brings me to an issue which is very important, our carrying capacity. So many people I've been talking to are against the idea of carrying capacity. I think we've read even in the press recently that there's these strong force fields against carrying capacity, but it's so important, especially on an island which has very few natural resources, which is very densely populated. You need to have a carrying capacity. You need to be able, not, I think in a lot of terms there was this word capping. It's not a form of capping. Carrying capacity is not capping. Carrying capacity is monitoring the amount of tourists you get to be able to provide the right quality and the right quality of those services and hospitality. So it's not really looking at saying, oh, we can only get that maximum, then you just close the door. That's not the idea of carrying capacity. You actually have to monitor the amount of tourists. I always talk about a tourist who wants to be at a destination, not the one who happens to be there. And that's the type of tourist who I believe is the quality tourist. Why am I saying this? Because a tourist who actually wants to be here is actually choosing to come to Malta. He's not choosing to come to a Mediterranean destination. That is a tourist who happens to be in a destination. And unfortunately, I've seen this happening over the last 30, 40 years, if not 50 years. We have had, and I won't say 50, because the first 10 years, 60s to the 70s, we had travel agency bookings, and travel agency is more or less people who want to come to Malta, and they had various reasons in the first 10 years.
Connections.
After 60s, they had connections, they had memories, there was a certain amount of connectivity in that respect. But when it came to tour operators, when it came to mass tourism, as we would like to call it, it's not mass tourism in terms of international mass tourism, but when it comes to mass tourism, it is based on price and on availability more than anything. And I think at the end of the day, what we want to consider is that type of tourist who is not just interested in price and connectivity alone. Those are important as well. But they're interested more in coming to Malta because they know that there's value here. There's somewhere here where they can have certain experiences. Now, whether those experiences are cultural, whether those experiences are community-based or relational-based, that's another thing.
Sports-based,
yes, exactly. And then you have the different, what we call niches today. I call them experiences, including the leisure market. Yes, that leisure market has to remain the mainstream because, as I was saying in the beginning, this is an island. So our main resource is the sea. Our main resource is the coastal area. You know, we have a weather which is, you know, very, very moderate. I know the last few weeks have been, probably people hearing me would say, you know, you haven't lived here for the last few weeks. Yes, I have lived here for the last few weeks. It's exceptional. But at the same time, it's still mild. You know, we don't have those harsh winters. We don't have long, harsh winters. We have probably moderate, you know, spring and summer, which gives us a good opportunity to promote that leisure market to that person who as well might want to experience other things. But I don't think, and I think one of the mistakes we've done in the past is that we have tried to market this island as a leisure resort, and at the same time we have tried to promote the idea of visiting Imdina, visiting historical sites. And to be honest, I don't think you can really fuse the two together, because a lot of times people, and I give an example here, you have a family, a young family, who have 3 or 4, 4-year-old, 5-year-olds, and they brought them on a leisure holiday for the sun and the sea, and you try and tell them, look, it's the middle of August, why don't you have a day trip and you can go to Imdina, go to Hajar'im. Can you imagine, you know, these people have come here for leisure. They, out of curiosity, because that's all you can say, out of curiosity, they might say, yes, let's go and see this medieval city. Let's go and see that the temples. I don't think their perception will match the experience, because they're not essentially culture tourists. They're here essentially for leisure. So let them enjoy that leisure. If we want people to come here and enjoy the culture, then we first have to promote it as a cultural center, you know, and the sites as cultural centers, and make sure that those people understand where they're coming from and where they're coming to.
In fact, what you go into in your doctoral thesis is the planning of a tourism that goes beyond the just the leisure. Tourism, that, as far as I can see, involves various types of culture as well, not just the visit to Imdina and to the Roman Domus.
That's right. It's actually a form of a methodology which is a consistent and continuous consultation process, which involves, I always talk, even with my students, about three key stakeholders, which are the local authorities, the local businesses, and the local communities. Unfortunately, a lot of times, it's only left to the local authorities and the local businesses to consult between them. The local communities are usually either an afterthought, or else a political or PR activity, just to say, we are consulting with you. But this is something which I think we need to take seriously, and we need to take consistently and continuously. It's not a case of having consultation at the beginning and the end of a project, but you need to involve that person if you want them to really be part of that project, and they should be part of the project. You need to involve them at every step. So what I've taken is basing it on three key areas, a rural area, an urban area, and a coastal area. And the rural area, I can say, was Dingley. The urban area was Boimla, and my coastal area was Melliha. Three very distinct areas, very, very different areas.
Melliha has something to offer, something different.
Well, Melliha is probably the most popular today with the tourists. So, I mean, you know that with 25% of the population there who are employed in one way or another in tourism, there's going to be a very, very strong argument in favor of further tourism in that area. So, you know, if you talk about having, you know, trying to reduce the seasonality issue, which is very serious there, by the way, in Melliha, by having other alternative experiences in that area, and there are alternative experiences, you're going to find the backing of the community because they understand it. But you need to involve them. In Dingley, you have a case where Dingley is very much seen as somewhere where on the outskirts you've got nature, you've got the cliffs, but very few people know about the history of the locality itself, which has a very interesting history, and the people are very interesting. But unfortunately, they are not part of the itineraries normally of the tourists. And in Boimla, it's the same thing. In Boimla, we talk about the three cities, but we talk about the three cities in terms of Birgu, in terms of Senglia. Unfortunately, Bohemla seems to be the Cinderella of the three cities. And ironically, that is one of the oldest localities, or let's say inhabited localities, in that area, because long before Burgu was actually developed, and it was more or less developed by the knights when they arrived here, there was just castle, which was today St. Angelo, Castello Amare, and that was it. Senglia was non-existent, it was just a peninsula that was used for hunting more often than not. So Bohemla is one of the oldest localities, and today it's one of the least visited by tourists. When there is such a lot of history there, all right, unfortunately we've lost a lot of our history during the Second World War because of the intense bombing in that area, but there are still places with proper interpretation, one can even understand the society and the community itself, which is an interesting side. And if you want people to be involved, then you need to make sure that somehow they are involved even in the history and interpretation itself. They are part of that interpretation. Unfortunately, we still see certain interpretation which is separating the host community from the history in a lot of localities. And I believe that if we're talking about history, if we're talking about interpretation locality, we have to include the host community. At the moment, I am working on a research study which started back in 2010 when I was still at the ministry, called Discovering Malta Ngozi Through Its People and Culture, and I'm working on this through the university today. I have a number of intern students working on this from Italy and from Spain, and the idea at the moment is that we're getting four local councils to work together to create a tour. But we're not talking about a sightseeing tour, but a community-based tour. And there is a difference, because we always talk about tours in terms of sightseeing. If it's, you know, the famous hop-on, hop-off buses, or if it's a guided tour, it's always mainly focusing on sightseeing. Okay, we say that we're going to meet some of the people, but in fact you're not meeting some of the people. You might be seeing them at a distance. You might be seeing a fisherman repairing his nets, or you might be seeing some person in the market, the open-air market, but that's not actually the interaction we're talking about. So that is what I call the sightseeing tours, which is a bit sort of, you know, separated from this community base. Now, the community base means that you're actually going to have the opportunity of literally meeting those people and getting to get that feel of what that village is about, hearing from them as well the history of that locality. So you're not just hearing the guide's view or the history from the guide, but you're speaking to that person, hearing the stories behind that history. And a lot of times, this is the most interesting. I'll take you back in 2008, when I was still working for the ministry, I prepared a draft local tourism plan for Melliha. And I worked for 6 months on that plan from the local council itself, because I felt that you can't work on something like that from the office, from Valletta. You have to work from...
Total immersion.
You have to. And one of the persons who took me around Melia and pointed out to me and showed me some of the most interesting spots in that locality was not someone who is a historian, or was not someone who was a researcher. He was somebody who was a volunteer who took care of one of the more prominent sites in Melia, which is the wartime shelters next to the sanctuary. And he actually showed me around the center, the local locality of Melia, the old center. And among the things which he showed me, and which I know no guide would actually probably know, was the graffiti on the old sanctuary. We always talk about the sanctuary as if it's the church. The church is actually the parish church, but the sanctuary is the old chapel underneath. And those graffiti, we hardly probably take any notice of them, because we think, you know, graffiti are just vandalism. They're not vandalism. Those are votive signs. They are votive graffiti. And among those is the Giuseppe Cali signature. So Giuseppe Cali actually visited there, and he was a pilgrim. These are pilgrims. These are people who visited that site for one reason or another. And it's only through this person that I actually got to know this. You don't understand this probably through a lot of books or through a lot of research, but you actually have to talk to the people. You have to discuss with the people. And this is part of what this process includes. This is why I say you need consistent, continuous consultation with the local community. Apart from the local businesses, apart from the local authority, yes, they are the two other key stakeholders. But you need to have the synergy with the local community if you want to develop community-based tourism, which I feel is the future for this industry.
One of the issues involved with community-based tourism, which I think is an extremely laudable idea, is the idea of commitment. I happen to know the person who runs the Meliha shelter, not personally but on the phone, because I've taken people there, and I know how committed he is. But I think the key word you used was volunteer, because somehow one has to perhaps look at the organizational side of getting people around communities in a different way, because it's not like probably having the Roman Domus belongs to Heritage, or is run by Heritage Malta. They're open, you know, certain hours, practically every day of the year, including Sundays. There is a bit of a challenge there with community, where people have other things to do. They might want to volunteer. Are they contactable? How real is it?
In fact, this was another issue which I discussed among the focus groups during my research. And yes, although it is very plausible to say that they are volunteers and they are committed volunteers, but a lot of times, yes, you have to understand that people do have other commitments today, so perhaps you need to give some sort of incentive to these volunteers. Not all volunteers, by the way, want this incentive. In Meliha, I have come across somebody this time who guides people, or not guides, but he interprets the museum at the sanctuary, and he knows every painting, and he'll explain to them every painting. And he actually commented to me and said, you know, people have come up to him and tried to give him, you know, a tip or money, and he doesn't even accept that. So, you know, there are a lot of very, very committed volunteers who will do this, and this is perhaps one of the ways that we need to develop community-based tourism in the future here. About a year ago, I was at Salisbury Cathedral. Many of your listeners or yourself might know this is one of the oldest cathedrals and one of the most beautiful, in my opinion, in the UK. And they have a very, very interesting system where they have volunteers who are normally retired teachers, retired anything, you know, people who are retired. I actually met a couple who had come from London down to Salisbury, and after they retired from their work and they settled in Salisbury, and they just wanted something to be able to do for the community.
Really positive. Mm-hmm.
And through this organization, which actually runs the interpretation and the hospitality and service at Salisbury Cathedral. Salisbury Cathedral, incidentally, has a number of very interesting high spots there, including one of the copies, because there's about three or four in the UK, of the Magna Carta. So this is one of the reasons why a lot of people as well visit that museum at Salisbury Cathedral. And through this volunteer organization, this interpretation is made more animated. And it is literally these people who are volunteers, you know, they could very easily, you know, because they're retired, they could very easily say, look, we've done our 40 years, 50 years of work, we just want to relax now. But no, they want to give back to society. So there are people who want to give back. But yes, in certain cases, that is possible. And I think that is the way that we need to look. We need to look at people who are literally volunteers and are committed volunteers, because they can contribute. A lot of them can contribute. Unfortunately, we're not taking much notice of them. So I think we need to give more attention to this. And this is maybe one way that we can do this. You know, if we can involve people, especially through consultation, through consistent consultation, we can improve this aspect of involvement. But yes, if there's a need to give some sort of incentive, then I think that has to be factored in as well. We can't take that out completely.
As you say, sometimes it'll be necessary and sometimes not. One little mapping exercise I had done in part of my own research was to ask local councils what private museums there were within their area.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say I got some fascinating results back. And there were people who were prepared to open up, for example, their butterfly collection on certain days of the week. But I would never have known about that unless I had actually gone searching for it.
No.
Somewhere along the line, there has to be, as part of the planning, I imagine, what you've sort of looked into this, how people can actually find out about
these. Well, one of the ways, funnily enough, I came across, I have a collection of very old guidebooks on Malta, and obviously when I was writing my book on the history of tourism in Malta and Goza, I had to use this as backup, so I have a number of books, and one of the books dates back to 1963 by Harold Rose, and the style that people wrote in those days, most of them were actually commissioned by the Malta Government Tourist Board to come and write about Malta, but they didn't produce guidebooks, which today, unfortunately, are very stereotypical. Today you have, an itinerary, you've got the places, and that's it. It's very cold. This is more animated, where he actually tells a story, and one of the stories is when he visited Nashar. Now today, what I'm going to say is probably going to be taken as a bit controversial, because he came across somebody who had a museum on stuffed birds. Very controversial, I know, at this time of the year. but what was interesting was nobody would have known about this private museum, about this private collection, let's say. So, through this book, he actually met the person, he was shown this collection, he was shown this museum, and so it is really by talking to people, by involving, and people will be proud of having been asked about these collections. I have seen this happening, to those people who, for a year up to Christmas, have built those famous cribs which we see, and I mean that takes them the best part of a year, just for a couple of weeks or 3 weeks exhibition. So these are committed people, and yet we need to involve them. I have also come across a young person who has a collection of different types of insects, different types of butterflies. Again, not many people know about this, unfortunately. So by talking to these people, by involving them, this is the way to give them a bit of incentive.
Unfortunately, our time has come to an end. Thank you very, very much,
Thank you very much, Mr. Julian Zarif, for coming to talk to us about planning tourism in Malta.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-programm li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġu plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.